Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Quick reminder, you can subscribe to us on Google, Stitcher, iTunes, any of those places. And if you leave positive comments, if you like what you actually hear, because we don't want you to lie on our behalf, I'm told that actually helps us. We've been talking a lot about Congress, about stonewalling, about constitutional crises. I think it's time to spend a little time talking about the economy. Because remember, I guess I'm old enough to remember when it was about the economy, stupid. Not sure that's true anymore, but there's always that possibility. So we are fortunate to be joined by Michael Strain, who is the Director of Economic Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Thanks for joining me, Michael. Appreciate it very much.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on. I'm a big fan.
Well, let's go back. You and I actually had a conversation when I was guest hosting at Sirius XM a few weeks ago, when there was a very real possibility that the president would have two new appointees, Herman Cain and Stephen Moore, on the Fed. And you were one of the conservatives who raised their hand and said that would really, really be a bad idea. Right? I mean,
yes. that's an accurate summary.
In fact, you wrote a piece against Cain as Fed chief, then oppose him now. That was more than a month ago, but it still is one of those moments to realize that there was a real possibility that the president of the United States would nominate somebody of questionable qualifications, dubious ideology, and non-existent independence who could end up as being the chairman of the Fed. And I thought you did a very good job explaining why that would be bad for the economy. So let's just remind folks about the bad signals that might have sent to the markets.
Yeah, I think focusing on the possibility that one of those nominees would have gone on to become the Fed chair is the right thing to focus on. The Fed is a kind of complicated institution in terms of its structure. There's a board of governors that are based in Washington that vote on interest rates. There are also presidents of regional Fed banks in cities around the United States that have seats on the interest rate setting committee and can vote as well. And really, the Fed chair has in recent decades been a very dominant presence in terms of what the Fed actually chooses to do in terms of monetary policy. The Fed's had wacky governors in the past. It can survive having some wacky governors. But my concern was that President Trump seemed, very much to want someone on the Fed who would be responsive to his priorities. I don't think there was much of mystery about that.
And what's wrong with that? I mean, a lot of people would say, hey, we live in a democracy. Why shouldn't the president have somebody on the Fed that reflects the economic policies that he ran on, won on, and is implementing?
So what's wrong with that is that there is a very powerful desire for politicians to have a good, strong economy today. The president wants the economy to be good right now. Members of Congress want the economy to be good right now because they have to run for reelection in the next 2 years or 4 years or 6 years, and they want to benefit from a strong economy when they run again. But that's not always in the best interest of the economy. In many situations, what's in the best interest of the economy is to have some short-term pain for long-term gain. And our political system is very bad at creating short-term pain, for long-term gain. And so the independence of the Fed from politics allows the Fed to have the kind of credibility with financial markets and with businesses and households in order to keep the currency stable and to avoid damaging bouts of inflation. If this were less insulated from politics, if this were more political, then the Fed would always keep the economy running hot. And that very likely would result in damaging inflation. And that would be bad for businesses, bad for households. Anybody who lived through the 1970s knows how damaging inflation can be. And so in order to keep inflation at bay, you need to keep the Fed independent of politics.
You know, you pointed out something that was sort of in the back of my mind, though, that when they were talking about putting them on, they would have been only a couple of votes, you know, had both of them been confirmed. I don't think it was ever likely that Kane was going to be confirmed, but Stephen Moore would be only one vote. But let me quote you to yourself. You wrote, "But what matters as much as whether Kane or Moore would simply do the president's bidding at the Fed is whether market participants think they would." Which is an interesting point. Price inflation today is determined in large part by what people and businesses think inflation will be in the future. The Fed has been successful at removing political considerations from expectations about future inflation. I thought that was, I have to tell you, when I read that, that changed my perspective on all of this, in terms of what actual impact they would have versus this whole question of how the markets would interpret it and might build that into future expectations.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, that is, I mean, you know, inflation is an interesting phenomenon, right? Because, like, ultimately the prices that people face are set by an actor in markets. You know, a grocery store has to decide what prices to charge for milk and bread and apples and bananas, and a lawn care business has to decide what price to charge for having somebody come mow the grass and plant flowers and that sort of thing. And market forces heavily influence those prices. Of course, supply and demand heavily influence the prices that are set. But they are set by market actors, you know, literally in many cases putting a price tag on an item or putting a price tag on a menu of services that are offered. And so psychology and the expectations of market actors about what the economy will be like and about what prices will be like really matters. And if everybody thinks that, the price of an apple is going to go up from 50 cents to $1 tomorrow, that puts pressure on people to raise the price of an apple today. It turns out that one of the most powerful predictors of what prices will be turns out to be what people think prices will be. And so economists put a lot of work into measuring those price expectations. And if markets started to think that the Fed was going to be more responsive to political pressure, then markets would think that inflation was going to be higher, and that could create this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. And that would be bad for people because they'd be facing higher prices.
Well, let's talk about the state of the economy right now, because we are living in what feels sometimes like the best of all possible worlds, fast growth, low unemployment, little or no inflation. But we have this cloud of a possible trade war hanging over us. Now, we are taping this in midweek. By the time people listen to us, things can change because this is the era of Trump. But talk to me about the impact of the trade controversies on the economy, particularly if, in fact, we go ahead and slap massive new tariffs on the Chinese. We're just a couple of days away from this. Now, of course, you know, some people think this is just Trump's negotiating strategy. It's an elaborate game of political chicken. But there's certainly the possibility that we could see real strains in trade. So how does the issue of free trade versus tariffs play into the health of the economy that we're enjoying right now?
Well, it's a drag on it. It's a drag on the economy's health, which is one of the most kind of paradoxical things about this entire situation. You know, the president is so focused on the economy and wants the economy to be as strong as possible. And it's really been one of his strongest arguments for the efficacy of his political leadership is, you know, hey guys, the economy's doing great. What don't you like? The record low unemployment or the, you know, stable prices or the stock market, or, you know, point to the thing you don't like. At the same time, he's pursuing this trade strategy that is resulting in significant declines in stock prices and that's serving to weaken the economy. And he's considering doing things that are, you know, that would be, you know, really very damaging to the economy, you know, like pulling out of NAFTA and these really dramatic actions that that would really threaten the health of the overall economy. So it's not good.
Does the president understand that China is not paying the tariffs, that U.S. consumers are paying the tariffs? I mean, this has gone on long enough. You would think that by now someone would have sat him down and say, look, tariffs are taxes on American consumers. They come out of the pockets of consumers. China is not writing a check to us. And yet that's not, that doesn't seem to be penetrating.
It's a great question. It would require a lot of time on the couch with the president, I think.
Economic CT scan. What is actually going on in there?
Something like that. You know, I think that there are. If you look at the president's long time in public life, there are a few things that he really seems to care about. And there are a few things that he really seems to believe. And one of those that he's been consistent about for decades has been this kind of mercantilist view of international trade, that if we are buying, if we're importing more than that we're exporting, that means that we are, you know, buying more of another country's goods than we're selling them, and therefore we're losing. You know, it's just, it's completely wrong. There's no serious economist who looks at international trade in that way. But he, you know, he really seems to believe it, and it's accruing to the detriment of the U.S. economy.
Well, the one critique, of course, that we hear from the left is, okay, so the stock market is booming, the unemployment is down, but this economy is extremely unequal. The effects are unequal, and we are seeing, and I don't want to throw out the word unprecedented because I don't have all the numbers in front of me, but certainly extraordinary levels of income inequality and wealth inequality. So should conservatives, or should whatever label you want, should we worry about income inequality and wealth inequality?
It's a great question. My first observation would be to point out that the strong economy actually has been accruing to the detriment of low-income people more than high-income people. If you actually look at whose wages are rising the fastest, for example, it's the wages of high school dropouts. It's the wages of the bottom 10%, the bottom 20% of wage earners. You know, that's really where the gains are being made. And so it's, you know, it's interesting that that the kind of political, you know, it's interesting that the politicians on the left, you know, are making this argument that all this prosperity that has been generated over the past few years is going to the top, because really it's people down at the bottom who are being helped the most, and you know, in ways that are, you know, addressing pretty urgent problems. You're seeing a lot of anecdotes, for example, of businesses being much more willing to hire applicants who were incarcerated. You're seeing significant improvements in the employment rate for workers with disabilities. You know, so not only, you know, your kind of, you know, run of the mill bottom 20% of wage earners, but people who really are, you know, rightly considered vulnerable workers are really benefiting from the economy.
But not as much as people on the top. I mean, the gap between, you know, upper middle class, upper class, and what we used to call the working class or the lower middle class is really dramatic. And the anxieties of the middle class are very, very different than our parents' generation. You know, a lot of the safety nets that people had taken for granted have just absolutely vanished. So is this middle class anxiety, is it just all in our heads? Is it an illusion?
So that's true over a longer time period. Let's just step back for a minute. You know, I think that the important thing for your listeners to take away is that this is a more nuanced story than they're getting from politicians on the left. So certainly, if you look over the past 30 years, you see that people at the top have been doing much, much better than people at the bottom in terms of their wage growth, in terms of their income growth, and really in terms of their kind of overall living standards. If you look over the past few years, what you see is that people at the bottom are improving. You know, their wages are growing and their incomes are growing at a faster rate than people at the top relative to the past few years. And what's happening is that the strong economy is finally delivering those benefits to people at the bottom as the unemployment rate drops, as we continue to add 200,000 jobs a month. It's people at the bottom who are benefiting the most from that.
And you're mentioning the growth in wages, which had lagged so far behind. And I know that you wrote about this a few weeks ago. So looking at the corporate tax cuts and all the tax cuts, in the end, do we have enough evidence to know whether or not they strengthened wages? Because of course, I mean, I was listening to the radio today and everybody's saying, well, you know, all the money went into stock buybacks, and certainly a lot of money did go into stock buybacks. So what is the relationship between those tax cuts and worker wages?
We don't know. You know, so you've got people on the left who are arguing that the tax cuts were a failure because of the stock buybacks, like you said. You've got people on the right who are arguing that the tax cuts were a big success because look at all these bonus payments that have been issued and all this sort of stuff. You know, both are wrong. And you know, what's actually happening here is a longer term economic process. What we should expect to have happen is you lower the corporate tax rate, you make some of these other changes to the corporate code, and that makes after tax profits higher for investment. That should induce additional investment. If companies are investing more, then that will make their workers more productive because their workers will have access to you know, better equipment and technology and those sorts of things. If workers' productivity go up, workers are more valuable to businesses, so businesses will work harder to attract and retain workers, including by paying higher wages. And so there's this multi-step process that takes you from a corporate tax cut to higher wages. And that takes time. That takes time to work through. And there just hasn't been enough time yet to know whether or not the corporate cuts have been a success or a failure for workers. I expect they'll be a success. Just not enough time has passed to know.
You know, there are a lot of smart people who think that elections are no longer determined by pocketbook issues, that it's not the economy anymore, that it is culture. But let's act on the assumption that the economy is still incredibly influential. And I wonder, I'm really wondering about 2020, looking ahead. Given the state of the economy right now, people may have all kinds of concerns and anxieties about the economy, but it is doing awfully well, certainly, you know, better than we have felt in a very, very long time. My 401k is doing very well, with the exception of the last couple of days. Unemployment, people are, I think...
Thank the trade war for that.
Exactly. You know, but you know, now the Democrats are coming in with these massive new, and they've kind of got this, you know, fever of free stuff, you know, free medical care, free daycare, free college plans. And they have convinced themselves somehow in their own bubble that these things are political winners. But I do wonder the extent to which people who are enjoying this economy will, in fact, look askance at someone who is pledging to fundamentally disrupt it in ways that are, I mean, and when I say fundamental, we're talking about trillion-dollar plans. And, you know, one Democrat after another seems to be bidding, well, here's my trillion-dollar plan for health care, my $31 trillion plan for health care, or my trillion-dollar plan for daycare, my trillion-dollar loan giveaway plan for college. I do think that people do love free stuff, but they also do want to know, number one, who's going to pay for it, and is this really going to kill the golden goose?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. You know, if you look back at the 1990s, for example, income inequality was right. It looked like in the 80s and 90s. Income inequality is going up and up and up. Nobody seems to care about it. Why does nobody care about it? Because there was broad-based, robust wage growth for everybody in the 1990s. Right now,
that's a good antidote to envy. If you're doing well, you're not likely to be ticked off that somebody else is doing better.
I think that's right. And right now, over the past 10 years or so, inequality actually hasn't been growing that much. By some measures, inequality has actually been falling. And yet, you know, you still see these Democrat politicians who are really, really worried about inequality and who are using that as a talking point. But what else has happened over the last 10 years? You know, we had a once in a generation financial crisis and severe recession. And so I think you're exactly right to be looking at this kind of current match between the economy and rhetoric about the economy and wondering what will happen. If people care, you know, if these wage gains continue and if people kind of continue to see themselves doing better off every year, you know, they really might say, well, you know, I don't care so much about this inequality that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren keep talking about because I'm doing better. On the other hand, you know, if they really do care about the rich poor gap, despite what's happening with their own pocketbooks, this will be a good test of that.
Well, one of the reasons why I know that you are an economic genius is because you agree with me on a number of these things, including about Elizabeth Warren's college loan plan.
It's an excellent litmus test.
it's a perfect litmus test. We agree on all of this, and I've written about this. You wrote about this back in April that Elizabeth Warren's great loan jubilee, we'll forgive almost everybody's loan, you pointed out is a subsidy for the comfortable class. And I have to say that I'm somewhat I'm pleased to see that there are folks, even on the left, who are going, yeah, this is not a very progressive plan. Brookings did an analysis and pointed out that most of the benefits do not go to the poorest Americans. So, I mean, and as you point out, this is a lavishly expansive transfer payment to people who are going to be doing a lot better over their working lives than some of the people who are going to be paying in.
Yeah, it's really kind of strange to me to see a progressive proposing this. You know, if you looked at the document that Senator Warren's campaign put out, you know, they give this example of a household that makes $160,000 a year. Maybe there's a lawyer in this household, maybe there's a doctor in this household, and that household with $160,000 a year income would get $30,000 of student loans just forgiven. That strikes me as a very bad use of that $30,000. I would much rather use that $30,000 to support economic opportunity for low income people. I'd rather use that $30,000 to reduce the deficit. We really should not be in the business of writing five figure checks to households with six figure incomes. I think there's a lot of politics here. Pretty much all the Democrats or a whole lot of them at least are who are running for president are campaigning on this, you know, free college tuition business or making college more affordable. There does seem to be a little bit of a dynamic here of Senator Warren saying, okay, well, I'll see your, you know, free tuition and I'll raise you, wiping out student debt.
there's a couple of things about this. I mean, number one, and I think I may have told this story before on the podcast. I can't remember, but I know that a lot of Democrats do think that this is a political winner. And I certainly remember a Wisconsin congressman who came back from a meeting of farmers who said, he knew the Democrats were going to lose because they were campaigning on free college. And he said all he had to do was sit and, you know, listen to the, I mean, look at the faces of the people in the room and they're going, I don't want to pay taxes to send some other kids, somebody else's kid to school. But also we've had decades of experience in which we've seen that the more the federal government or state governments throw at higher education, the higher the cost goes. I mean, there's actually a thing called Bowen's Law, which is that every institution raises all that it can and spends all that it can. And so, you know, the experience that we've had is that every time we have one of these programs, the incentive of a college to make themselves leaner, meaner, more efficient is diminished. And the incentive for them to embrace the law of more building, more bureaucrats, more spending, is enhanced. So I'm not sure that she solves the problem other than to create another sort of government, you know, massively expensive government transfer program.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I think that's right. You know, this would cost, they estimated, I think, $1.3 trillion over 10 years. And
which is a lot of money.
It's really a lot of money. And, you know, what we need to be doing is thinking about ways to get lower income workers the skills they need to compete in the modern economy, to raise their wages, to raise the wages they can command in the market. And that's not going to be the traditional four-year college model for a whole lot of people. We need to be thinking of new ways to do this and not pumping money into a system that's not working well for everyone.
Well, I'm really glad to hear you say that, because, I mean, I understand that college for all has become kind of the this overall mantra that everybody just assumes that in order to be a, you know, lead a successful life, you have to go to college. And for many people, that's absolutely true. There's no question about it. A college education is often a very good life choice, and it does pay off. However, you know, not everyone needs to get a four-year degree. We have too many kids who are going to educational programs that may not be the best fit for them, and perhaps they could get a better, more productive, more valuable education in 2 years or some other form of alternative, and just lavishing the free money doesn't quite do it. By the way, there's just another question of equity that that's sort of out there. There are people who work really hard, who save lots of money, and who did pay for their own or their children or their grandchildren's college education with cash. And I wonder how they're going to feel when, in fact, the government comes and pays off the debt of all the people who didn't do that. It's kind of like the old ant and grasshopper academic version of that story.
Sure. I got a couple of emails from people after I published that column who told me that just this last couple of months, they wrote their final check to pay off their student loans, and they said, they were not happy about the idea that they put in all that work to pay off the loan they had incurred, and that they may not have had to do that.
Oh no, I can certainly imagine that. You also wrote an interesting piece the other day about the two earner family. There's a line of conservative thought now suggesting that. That one of the things that has weakened the American family has been the entry of women into the workplace, and the higher cost of middle class life. And you're basically saying that that's insulting, it's wrong, and we should stop poor mouthing the two earner family. What is your point?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think that it's wrong analytically. So the idea is that women started working and all of a sudden households had more income. And so, the competition for nice houses in good school districts heated up, and that jacked up home prices, and the competition for, other goods and services heated up, and that jacked up their prices. And so what ended up happening is that, incomes went up, prices went up, nobody's better off than they were before women started working, and that's just not accurate. If you look at the data, yes, of course it's true that a lot of prices have gone up, but incomes have gone up faster than prices, and it just seems kind of silly to blame the income that women working has generated on those price increases. I mean, we just talked about education. If you look at housing and healthcare as well and other areas, their prices have gone up in large part because the government pours money into subsidies for those programs and restricts their supply. And if we weren't restricting supply we weren't subsidizing demand, then prices would have been a lot slower in terms of their growth. But it also seems to, it seems to blame women in kind of a normative sense. I think that certainly is insulting.
It does seem unfortunate that that you really do need a two-income family to be middle class these days, or at least that's the assumption. And I guess people are somewhat nostalgic for a time, maybe in the 1950s, the 1960s, which may not have existed except in their imagination, where in fact, you know, one breadwinner, you know, could support an entire family, and that we were relatively satisfied with that standard of living. But that seems more nostalgia than analysis to me.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of nostalgia to it, but I also think there's a lot of, I mean, I just find it to be a weird argument to make, you know, because there are a lot of households with one breadwinner. You know, my wife works, and so, you know, we're a two earner family, but I know a lot of people living in Washington D.C. Where one spouse works and one spouse stays home with the kids. Back home in the Midwest where I'm from, I know a lot more people who do that, and they live very comfortable middle class lives. You know, both here and people back home, and you know, I think we all know people where one of the spouses stays home and raises the kids, and you know, that presents challenges. There's no question about it. But having both spouses work presents challenges as well. And you know what this is a choice, and I think we should respect the choices that dual earner couples make, and we should respect the choices that single earner couples make.
So, going back to a question we talked about before, and maybe because I'm thinking the answer might involve trade, but given how strong this economy is and how durable this economy is going into 2020, what do you see as the threats to it, if any, other than a trade war, which I think everyone understands? It does not appear that we are on the verge of runaway inflation. Corporate earnings continue to be relatively strong. What should we be looking at, worrying about?
So with respect to 2020, I expect that the economy will slow in 2019 and 2020 relative to 2018 and 2017. And so there is a line of analysis that suggests that what actually matters is the trajectory the economy is on for an incumbent's ability to win re-election. And so if the economy is slowing, even if it's still strong, you know, that could be problematic for the president. In terms of the risk to the economy, there are a few big ones. One is a foreign slowdown, you know, a slowdown in Europe, a slowdown in China. You know, there are some trouble spots out on the horizon. You know, there could be a major crisis in Italy, for example, that could very negatively impact the U.S. economy. There could be, you know, a major crisis in the United Kingdom, depending on how the Brexit negotiations go. There could be a relatively severe slowdown in China. So I would keep an eye out on the global economy and how that might impact the U.S. economy. Another major risk is a mistake by the Federal Reserve. You know, the Fed's in a tough spot right now, and what the Fed wants to do is to, you know, kind of allow the pace of job growth to either remain stable or to slow without pushing it negative. The Fed wants to allow the unemployment rate to stay stable or to rise without pushing it into a recession. In other words, the Fed wants to engineer what's called a soft landing, where it doesn't kill off the expansion, but it also does its duty to make sure we don't have problematic inflation. That's very hard to do. The Fed has shown a pretty significant willingness to change course. You know, everybody thought there were going to be several interest rate increases this calendar year. The Fed was signaling that that's what it wanted to do. It's changed its mind. You know, because the data, it's changed its reading on the data. But the Fed's in a tough spot in assessing economic conditions and in executing a monetary policy that won't push the economy into recession, but that also won't lead to bad inflation. So a Fed mistake is a problem as well. You know, if there's some sort of a, you know, if we really do end up in a trade war with China, where we're seeing tit for tat tariff increases, that could be a significant problem for the economy as well. So, you know, there are a number of trouble spots out
well,
there.
Well, what about debt and deficits? Even somebody who former deficit hawk like Mick Mulvaney is basically saying, yeah, it's not much of an effect anymore. And it almost appears to sort of have vanished from the public agenda. So where do you come down on this? We are looking at massive increases in the national debt. And obviously, that's not going to affect the economy dramatically, perhaps in the next year. But how does that factor into your looking ahead to the strength of the in the future of the American economy?
I think deficits of the size that we currently have and the trajectory of the national debt are extremely problematic. And they will have a real negative impact on the economy's performance. They'll have a real negative impact on household income, and they need to be dealt with. I think you're right to draw this distinction, you know, between this year versus kind of longer term. You know, I don't, you know, if anything, they're helping the economy's performance this year and will continue to do so, you know, relative to a world where we tried to balance the budget, for example. But over the long term, they're going to be a drag on household income and they need to be dealt with. And what's really troubling right now is this bipartisan consensus that's not correct. So, you know, we need one of these two parties or ideally both, but at least one of the two to pick up the mantle of fiscal responsibility again.
Yeah, I don't see that happening for a while. I suppose the good news is that after that announcement that there was a bipartisan agreement for a $2 trillion infrastructure plan, it went the way of all infrastructure plans. I'm sorry. It's how infrastructure became the running joke and the punch. I mean, think about it. You know, had Donald Trump come in and made his first item of business a bipartisan infrastructure bill, I mean, think how differently the politics and the trajectory of his presidency would be. And instead, Infrastructure Week has become the joke. And of course, the only good thing you can say about that deal that he allegedly struck with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi is that no one thinks it's going to happen, that there's any possibility at all. But I mean, you know, faced with these massive deficits in this debt, the fact that both parties are talking about these dramatic increases in spending and that apparently you are not taken seriously unless it's got a T in the front of it. I mean, that's what rattles me, I guess. But then, I'm an unreconstructed budget hawk. Michael Strain, thank you so much for joining me. Director, Economic Policy Studies, and the John Searle Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Thanks so much, Michael, for spending time with us.
Thanks so much for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow and do this all over again.